10 years ago this month, we just celebrated the anniversary, a Palestinian civil society issued a historic call for BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Israel until it complies with international law and respects the very basic human rights of the Palestinian people. This incredible historic call has totally, fundamentally transformed the solidarity movement with Palestine and has really given a tool to everyday people around the country to look at our own complicity with Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people, to look at in what ways are we purchasing products that are made in illegal Israeli settlements, in which ways are we invested in companies, U.S. corporations often, that are involved in violating the fundamental rights of Palestinians. How is our government, of course, first and foremost, implicated in providing Israel with the diplomatic and financial protection and assistance that it requires to oppress the Palestinians every day. And so I've been working with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation to support organizations around the country. We are a coalition of several hundred organizations, support those organizations in building up BDS campaigns to hold Israel accountable and to really bring the story of Palestine to our communities here in the United States to understand what is happening and to end our complicity in a way that was very effectively used to help end apartheid in South Africa. And the BDS call is actually modeled off of the anti-apartheid movement.
Well, let's talk about the three different components, the boycott, the divestment, and then sanctions. I know we have certainly had guests on here hotly debating the efficacy of things like boycott, particularly, say, in the context of an academic boycott. What good does that in fact do? Let's talk about when you're talking about a boycott, what does that mean? When you're talking about divestment, which actual financial areas are the funds that are, you know, being divested from? And then what are sanctions and what form do they take?
Great question. So boycotts can refer to several different things. You've already alluded to one. Boycotts can be about consumer boycotts when we think about the grapes boycott, that sort of thing. It can also be academic boycott, cultural boycott. So taking, for example, the consumer boycott. So there are products, for example, SodaStream, which until very recently was produced in an illegal Israeli settlement. And it's a homemade seltzer maker, basically. And it was being sold in U.S. stores coming right off the shelves of this Israeli settlement. And so we were, there are hundreds of organizations around the world, actually, that built up boycott campaigns saying, do not buy these products. This is a way of supporting the Israeli occupation. And it was extremely effective. In fact, just recently, SodaStream closed its factory in the West Bank and moved out of it. Of course, we continue boycotting because SodaStream has now moved on to stolen Bedouin land in the Palestinian Negev. But it just shows really the power behind consumer boycott when it's done effectively.
So is the boycott on, say, products or, you know, academia or whatever happening on occupied land or the entire country of Israel?
Good question. When we look at choosing a target for a BDS campaign, and BDS, by the way, is not it's a tactic, not a dogma. We do not boycott things willy-nilly. We look at what are strategic targets. What's a target that tells the story of what is happening? What is a target that is clearly implicated in the oppression of the Palestinian people? So it is not about the geography, whether it's located in the West Bank or inside Israel or inside the United States. It's about institutional connections to the oppression of the Palestinian people. So another very common boycott target is, for example, the French multinational Veolia, which until very recently, this is another amazing BDS victory, until very recently was providing all kinds of services within the occupation. Another example is the world's largest private security contractor, G4S, which is based in the UK, which also services detention centers here in the United States, but is heavily implicated in Israel's mass incarceration of Palestinian political prisoners and continues to be today. And so people have, for example, looked at contracts within their own municipalities. So, for example, is Boulder contracted with Veolia? I know the answer is actually yes. RTD does use Veolia services. Is Boulder contracted with G4S for security contracts? What about local companies? Are they using G4S? And we can focus in on these contracts and try to end them as a way of ending our own complicity with the oppression of Palestinians and of telling that story. So we look for strategic targets. Now, you also mentioned other kinds of boycotts. So, for example, example, the academic boycott and the cultural boycott of Israel. These are extremely important, and I actually believe are among the most effective tactics in terms of sending a message that there can be no business as usual with Israeli occupation. One thing that people often don't realize is that Israeli academic and cultural institutions are part and parcel of its oppressive regime.
In what ways?
So, for example, a couple examples. So Israeli settlements are designed in Israeli academic institutions. Israeli academic institutions play a role in excluding Palestinians and marginalizing Palestinians who are inside Israeli the Israeli society. And these you can find all kinds of details on, and to flesh all of these things out, if you look at the Palestinian Call for Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel page, PACBI.org. Cultural boycott, for example. So Israeli cultural performers. This is important, and I encourage people to look at the PACBI.org website to look at the guidelines. But we can see the way in which cultural performers are actually enlisted by Israel to put a pretty face on apartheid Israel. So when we're talking about individual Israelis, because again this is about institutional links. An individual Israeli can do whatever they want. But if you are traveling to, for example, the United States, you're an Israeli cultural performer coming to the United States as an ambassador of the State of Israel, and many of them are actually asked to sign waivers to say that they will be representing the state's interest. You are coming in, oftentimes this is actually explicit policy, to really put a pretty face on Israel, to whitewash Israel's crimes. And Israeli think tanks found recently that, not recently actually, it was a while ago now, that Israel's image was deteriorating internationally. That because really of how egregious its human rights violations are, and because of the activism of people like us, that people were not really buying Israel as a victimized country anymore. And so they developed a strategy that said basically, we need to divert attention away from Israel's military actions and focus more on Israel's technological, scientific, academic, cultural, and artistic accomplishments. In other words, let's focus on Israel as that pretty artistic, technological, you know, ecological country, and not talk about the way that it abuses the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people, millions of people. And so we see the ways in which cultural and academic institutions are very much involved in Israel's oppressive policies, and it's very important that we launch campaigns to boycott them, because it also has a really huge effect. You know, people weren't paying attention when we were showing films about the oppression of Palestinians, when we were just standing on street corners with signs. But when we start to say, no, we're not going to have business as usual with an Israeli academic institution that is part and parcel of oppression of Palestinians. No, we are not going to welcome an Israeli academic cultural ambassador that is coming to put a pretty face on occupation. They pay attention. And we can see that BDS is now considered a major strategic threat to Israel's ongoing policies.
Has it been impactful in any way in affecting change in policy in improving the life of the Palestinians? I mean, give us some examples of how it has been impactful.
So we can see through historic social justice struggles, let's take the anti-apartheid movement, for example, that, you know, these things happen in stages. Oftentimes the oppressive power becomes more oppressive as it sort of tightens its grip. What we can already see very clearly is the number of victories that have been achieved in just 10 years surpasses the number that was achieved in, I think, at least double that time in the anti-apartheid movement. If you take when South Africans began calling for boycotts and divestment and sanctions. So if you actually look at our website, endtheoccupation.org/BDS100, you will find a list of more than 100 U.S. victories. In the United States alone, tremendous victories. We see the way in which this has transformed the discourse around Israel-Palestine and the ways in which institutions themselves are severing those links. We see that corporations are changing their policies. SodaStream closed its factory in the West Bank. G4S has announced that it plans to end its contracts with Israel. Veolia ended its contract with Israel. We are seeing one by one the way in which this pressure really works. And yes, eventually, we believe that it will force the U.S. and Israel to change. change its ways. And we know that the S part, you know, there's a reason it goes BDS. The S is always last. You know, the U.S. did not wake up and decide to end its complicity with apartheid South Africa. It was after decades of boycott and divestment tactics and other forms of resistance that the U.S. finally came to its senses. And that's what we expect will happen here.
Now, when I introduced you, I said that you're an American Jewish activist as part of that. That is so important because so often these efforts around Israel, whether it's BDS movement or even just speaking out in criticism of the Israeli government, they're labelled by supporters of Israel as being anti-Semitic, and those lines are blurred, and that creates a lot of, I think, conflict for people who want to engage in this dialogue. I mean, what is that like for you to be an American Jew as part of this, and how important is it that other American Jews raise their voice as well?
It's very important that everybody raise their voice, Jews and non-Jews alike. The BDS movement and the Palestinian movement for rights is opposed to all forms of racism and bigotry, including anti-Semitism. It's personally offensive to me as a Jewish person when somebody says that criticism of Israeli occupation and Israeli oppression is criticism of Judaism. You know, military occupation has nothing to do with Judaism, and criticizing it is in no way against Jews. In fact, it's in line for me with a tradition that has been in my community, at least to struggle for social justice for all people. It's important to actually lift up, especially right now, as the Palestine solidarity movement popularizes here in the U.S. in a way that we welcome. That oftentimes it's actually Jewish voices that are privileged in this conversation, precisely because people are afraid of being called anti-Semitic, precisely because people are considered a novelty for a Jewish American to speak out, that oftentimes our voices are actually lifted above the real experts, which are the Palestinian people. And the U.S. has a large Palestinian community that has been struggling for more than 60 years for their liberation. And one of the beautiful things about BDS is that it comes from Palestinian civil society, and it really places Palestinians back at the center of that struggle and of that conversation.
You mentioned the role that Jewish Americans have to play in speaking out against what's happening there, but in other forms of racism. And I know locally we've had a group form, Jewish Allies, as Jews as Black Allies, speaking out as part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I know you've been involved in that as well. Tell us about how those two causes are kind of coming together in your work there.
Sure. So I happen to live in St. Louis, about 20 minutes from Ferguson, and I've been heavily involved there. I mean, for me, it's obviously a matter of principle, and for our organization, I mean, we've really wanted to invest in this Black struggle in St. Louis and Ferguson and around the country, because we see the ways in which Black communities are under attack worldwide. Probably worldwide, but certainly countrywide, in mass incarceration, police brutality, and all different forms, the legacy of slavery, really. And we see this as an ethical imperative, that this is something to do for our principles. And we also see that there are many connections. The ways that the same tear gas that is used against Ferguson protesters is used against the Palestinian people when they nonviolently protest for their rights. U.S. Police forces that are killing Black youth around our country are being trained by Israel in population control, Israel having sophisticated expertise for more than 60 years now in controlling the Palestinian population. The connections are very clear, and it's been really beautiful to witness as a white Jewish ally to the struggle there, the ways in which the Palestinian and Black community have joined together to oppose all forms of racism, to focus, of course, right now that Black lives matter, and we want justice for Mike Brown and all like him, but also to see the way in which the different struggles are viewed within a broader framework of commitment to ending racism and oppression, no matter where it happens.